pointed at the leather pouch. Take it. Split it between you. Use it to get far away. Start a new life.
A new life?
That's right, Master Campbell said. You could even buy yourselves swords. Morley blinked in astonishment.
Swords?
Of course. There is enough there to buy you each a dozen swords. If you went to a new land, you wouldn't be thought of as Hakens, as you are here. In many places, you would be free men, and you could buy yourselves swords. Get yourselves a new life. New work, new everything. With money like that, you could meet nice women and court them properly.
But we've never even been out of Fairfield, Morley said, near tears.
Dalton Campbell put his hands on his desk and leaned toward them.
If you stay here, you will be put to death.
Guards have your names and are no doubt searching for you as we speak. They are probably right on your heels. I pray to the Creator they didn't see you coming up here. If you want to live, take the money and run. Find yourselves a new life. Fitch snatched a quick look over his shoulder. He didn't see anyone or hear anyone, but they could be on them at any moment. He didn't know what to do, but he did know they had to do as Dalton Campbell said and get away. Fitch swept the leather pouch off the desk.
Master Campbell, you are the best man I've ever known. I wish I could have worked for you for the rest of my life. Thank you for telling us they're after us and giving us a start.
Dalton Campbell reached out with a hand. Fitch had never clasped hands with an Ander before, but it felt good. It made him feel like a man. Dalton Campbell gripped Morley's hand, too.
Good fortune to you both.
I would suggest you get some horses. Buy them, don't steal them, or that will give them your trail. I know it will be difficult, but try to act normal, or you will make people suspicious. Take care with the money. Don't waste it on prostitutes and rum, or it will be gone before you know it. If that happens, you will be caught, and you won't live long enough to die from the diseases the whores give you. If you use your heads with the money, spend it frugally, it will keep you in good stead for a few years, give you time to establish new lives, wherever you find you like it. Fitch reached out and shook hands again.
Thank you for all the advice, Master Campbell. We'll do as you say. We'll buy horses and then get away. Don't you worry about us. Both Morley and I have lived on the streets before. We know how not to get caught by Anders wishing us harm.
Dalton Campbell smiled.
I suppose you do.
May the Creator watch over you, then. When Dalton returned to the feast, he found Teresa sitting in his chair, engaged in an intense conversation with the minister. Her lilting laugh chimed above, while Bertrand's chuckle rumbled below, the middling drone of the feast. Hildemara, Stein, and the merchants at the other end of the table were engrossed in their own whispered discussion. Smiling, Teresa reached out and took Dalton's hand.
There you are, darling. Can you stay now, please?
Bertrand, tell Dalton he works too hard. He has to eat.
Why, yes, Dalton, you do work harder than any man I've known. Your wife is frightfully lonely without you. I've been trying to keep her entertained, but she isn't interested in my stories. She is quite polite about it, even though she only wishes to tell me what a good man you are when I already know it.
Bertrand and Teresa encouraged him to return to his seat as she moved back to hers. Dalton held a finger up to his wife, imploring patience for just a moment longer. He moved around and put one hand on the minister's shoulder and the other on Hildemara's as he leaned down between them. They both tipped their heads in.
I have just now received new information that confirms my suspicions. As it turns out, the first reports of the crime were sensationalized. Claudine Winthrop was in reality murdered by just two men.
He handed the minister a folded piece of paper secured with a wax seal.
Here are their names.
Bertrand took the paper as a smile spread on his wife's face.
Now, please, listen carefully, Dalton added. I was on to them, but before I was able to arrest them, they stole a great deal of money from the kitchen account and escaped. An intensive search is already underway.
He'd lifted a questioning eyebrow as he looked to each face to make sure they understood he was fabricating a story for a reason. Their own expressions told him they grasped the unspoken meaning between his words.
Tomorrow, when it pleases you, announce the names of the men on that piece of paper. They worked in the kitchen. They raped and killed Claudine Winthrop. They raped a Haken girl who works for the butcher Inger. And now they have robbed the kitchen account and run.
But won't the Haken girl have something to say? Bertrand asked.
worried she might deny they were the ones and turn the finger to him if forced to talk. Unfortunately, the ordeal was too much for her, and she ran off. We don't know where she went, probably to live with distant family, but she won't be back. The city guard has her name. Should she ever try to return, I will know about it first and personally see to her interrogation.
Then she isn't here to contradict the conviction of the murderers.
A scowl returned to Hildemar's face.
Why should we give them the night to escape? That's foolish. The people will want an execution, a public execution. We could give them quite the show of it. Nothing like a good public execution to satisfy people.
Dalton took a patient breath.
The people want to know who did it. Bertrand is going to give them the names. That will show everyone the minister's office discovered the killers. That they ran before the names were even announced proves them guilty.
Dalton drew down his own brow. Anything more than that could bring trouble in the form of the mother confessor. That is trouble beyond our ability to control.
An execution would serve no purpose and bring great risk. The people will be satisfied with knowing we have solved the crime and the killers are no longer among them. To do more would risk everything as we stand in the doorway to the sovereign's chamber.
Hildemar began to object.
The man is right, Bertrand said with authority.
She relented.
I suppose. I will make an announcement tomorrow, with Edwin Winthrop at my side if he is well enough,
Bertrand said.
Very good, Dalton. Very good indeed. You've earned yourself a reward for this one.
Dalton smiled at last.
Oh, I have that all planned out too, Minister.
Bertrand's sly chuckle returned.
No doubt, Dalton, no doubt.
The laugh turned to a belly laugh that even infected his wife. Fitch had to wipe tears from his eyes as he and Morley rushed down the halls of the estate. They went as fast as they could without running, remembering what Dalton Campbell told them about trying to act normal. When they saw guards, they quickly changed their route to avoid being seen up close. From a distance, Fitch was just a messenger and Morley an estate worker. But if they saw any guards and the guards tried to stop them, then they would have to bolt. Fortunately, the ruckus of the feast covered the sound of their feet on the wood floors. Fitch had an idea that might help them escape. Without explaining, he pulled Morley's sleeve, urging him to follow. Fitch turned them to the stairwell. They took the steps two at a time down to the lower floor. Fitch made two turns and in short order found the room he wanted. It was deserted. Carrying a lamp, they both slipped inside and shut the door.
Fitch, are you crazy shutting us in here? We could be halfway to Fairfield by now.
Fitch licked his lips.
Who are they looking for, Morley?
Us.
No, I mean, from the way they're thinking, who are they looking for? A messenger and a kitchen scullion, right?
Morley scratched his head as he kept looking at the door.
I guess.
Well, this is the estate supply room, where they keep some of the livery. Before a seamstress fitted me up with my uniform, I got one from down here to wear till she was done with mine.
Well, if you got your uniform, then what are we doing?
Take off your clothes.
Why?
Fitch growled in frustration.
Morley, they're looking for a messenger and a scullion. If you put on a messenger's outfit, then we'll be two messengers.
Morley's eyebrows went up.
Oh, that's a good idea.
In a rush, Morley stripped out of his filthy scullion clothes. Fitch held out the lamp as he searched the shelves for outfits of messengers for the minister's aide. He tossed Morley some dark brown trousers.
Do these fit?
Morley stepped into the legs and pulled them up.
Good enough.
Fitch pulled out a white shirt with ruffled collar.
How about this?
Fitch watched as Morley tried to button it. It was too small to fit over Morley's broad shoulders.
Fold it back up,
Fitch said as he searched for another. Morley tossed the shirt aside.
Why bother?
Pick it up and fold it back up. You want us to get caught? I don't want it to look like we was down here. If they don't know someone took clothes, then we can get away better.
Oh,
Morley said. He picked up the shirt and started folding with his big hands. Fitch handed him another that was only just a little too big. In short order, Fitch found a sleeved doublet quilted with an interlocking cornucopia design. The edges were trimmed with the distinctive brown and black braided wheat banding of Dalton Campbell's messengers. Morley poked his arms through the sleeves. It fit fine.
How do I look?
Fitch held up the lamp. He let out a low whistle. His friend was built a lot stouter than Fitch. In the messenger uniform, Morley looked almost noble. Fitch never thought of his friend as good-looking, but now he was a sight.
Morley, you look better than Rowley does.
Morley grinned.
Really?
The grin vanished.
Let's get out of here.
Fitch pointed.
Boots. You need boots, or you'll look foolish. Here, put on these stockings, or you'll get blisters.
Morley hauled up the stockings, and then sat on the floor while he matched up boot soles with the bottom of his foot until he found a pair that fit. Fitch told him to pick up all his old clothes so no one would know they had been there and taken an outfit, if they even discovered it missing. There was a lot of livery stored in the room, and it wasn't orderly enough to tell if one outfit was gone. When they heard boots in the hall, Fitch blew out the lamp. He and Morley stood frozen in the dark. They were too terrified to breathe. The boots came closer. Fitch wanted to run, but if they did, they would have to run out the door, and that was where the men were. Men. He realized it was boots from two men. Guards. Guards making their rounds. Once again, Fitch felt panic at the idea of being put to death before a jeering crowd. Sweat trickled down his back. The door opened. Fitch could see the man standing with his hand on the doorknob, outlined in the dim light from the hall. He could see the sword at the man's hip. Fitch and Morley were back a ways in the room, in an aisle between shelves. The long rectangle of light from the doorway fell across the floor and came almost right up to Fitch's boots. He held his breath. He dared not move a muscle. Maybe, he thought, the guard, his eyes accustomed to the light, didn't see the two of them standing there in dark. The guard closed the door and walked on with his fellow, who was opening other doors in the hall. The sound of footsteps receded into the distance.
Fitch, Morty said in a shaky whisper. I'd be needing to relieve myself something awful. Can we get out of here, please?
Fitch had to force his voice to return.
Sure.
He made for where he remembered seeing the door in the pitch blackness. The light of the empty hall was a welcoming sight. The two of them hurried on to the nearest way out, the service entrance not far from the brewer's room. Along their way, they dumped Morley's old clothes in a rag bin near the service dock. They heard the old brewer singing a drunken song. Morley wanted to stop and lift something to drink. Fitch licked his lips as he considered Morley's idea. It sounded good to him, too. He surely would like a drink right then.
No,
he finally whispered.
I'd not like to be put to death for a drink. We have plenty of money. We can buy a drink later. I don't want to be here a second longer than necessary.
Morley nodded reluctantly. They rushed out the service doors and out onto the dock. Fitch leading, they hurried on down the steps. The steps Claudine had come up the first time he and Morley had their talk with her. If only she'd listened to them and done as Fitch warned her.
Aren't we going to get any of our things? Morley asked.
Fitch stopped and looked at his friend standing in the light coming from the estate windows.
You got anything worth dying for?
Morley scratched his ear.
Well, no, I guess not. Just a nice carved stick game my pa gave me. I guess I don't have much else but some of my other clothes, and they're just rags, really. This outfit is better than any of them, even my assembly clothes.
Penance assembly. Fitch realized with a sense of joy they would never have to go to penance assembly again.
Well, I don't have anything worth taking either. I got a few coppers left in my trunk, but that's nothing compared to what we're carrying now. I say we get to Fairfield and buy some horses.
Morley made a face.
You know how to ride a horse?
Fitch looked around to make sure there weren't any guards about. He gave Morley a gentle shove to get them moving.
No, but I reckon we'll learn fast enough.
I reckon, Morley said. But let's buy gentle horses.
As they made the road, they both looked back over their shoulders at the estate for the last time.
I'm glad to be away from there, Morley said. Especially after what happened in there today. I'll be glad not to have to go into that kitchen again.
Fitch frowned over at his friend.
What are you talking about?
You didn't hear?
Hear what? I was off in Fairfield delivering messages.
Morley grasped Fitch's arm and brought them to a panting halt.
About the fire? You didn't hear about the fire?
Fire?
Fitch was baffled.
What are you talking about?
Down in the kitchen, earlier today. Something went crazy wrong with the ovens and the hearth, the whole thing.
Wrong? Like what?
Morley lifted his arms up as he made a roaring sound with the spit in his throat. His arms spread, apparently to imitate flames expanding outward.
It just flared up something awful. Burned the bread. It got so hot it split a cauldron. No,
Fitch said in astonishment.
Did anyone get hurt?
A fiendish grin spread on Morley's face. Gilly got burned real bad. With an elbow, he jabbed Fitch in the ribs. She was making a sauce when the fire went crazy. She got her ugly prune face burned up. Her hair was afire and everything. Morley laughed with the satisfaction of one who had waited years for recompense. She probably won't live, they say. But at least as long as she lives, she'll be in a horrible pain. Fitch had mixed feelings. He felt no sympathy for Gilly, but still.
Morley, you shouldn't be glad an Ander got hurt. That just shows our hateful Haken ways.
Morley made a scornful face, and they started out again. They ran the entire way, diving into the fields three times when a carriage came along the road. They hid in the wheat or the sorghum, depending on which side offered the most cover. There they lay and caught their breath until the carriage passed. In a way, Fitch found the experience of running away more a liberation than a frightful flight. Away from the estate, he felt less fear of getting caught, at night anyway.
I think we should hide in the day, he said to Morley. In the beginning, at least. Hide in the day somewhere safe as we go along, and where we can see if anyone is coming. We can travel at night so people won't see us, or if they do, won't be able to see who we are.
But what if someone finds us in the day when we're sleeping?
We'll have to stand watches, just like soldiers do. One of us stands watch while the other gets sleep.
Morley seemed to find Fitch's logic a marvelous thing.
I never thought of that.
They slowed to a walk as they neared the streets of Fairfield. There they knew how to disappear as effectively as they did in the fields when a carriage came along the road.
We can get some horses, Fitch said, and still make some distance tonight.
Morley thought a minute.
How are we going to get out of Andreth?
Master Campbell said there are places where it don't matter that we're Haken, but how are we going to get past the army at the border with the Dominie Dirch?
Fitch gave the shoulder of Morley's doublet a tug.
We're messengers, remember?
So?
So, we say we have official business.
Messengers have official business outside of Andoreth?
Fitch gave that some thought.
Well, who's to say we don't? If we say we have urgent business, they can't keep us until they send word back. That would take too long.
They might ask to see the message.
We can't be showing secret messages to them now, can we? We'll just say it's a secret mission to another land we can't name, with an important message they aren't allowed to see.
Morley grinned.
I think this is going to work. I think we're going to get away.
You bet we are.
Morley pulled Fitch to a halt.
Fitch, where are we going to go? Do you have any idea about that part of it?
This time it was Fitch who grinned. Chapter 43 Beata squinted in the bright sun as she set down her bag. She wiped her wind-blown hair back from her eyes. Since she couldn't read, she couldn't tell what the sign above the towering gate said, but there was a number before it, 23. She knew numbers, so she knew she'd found the place. She stared at the word after the number, trying to remember it so she might someday recognize it for the word it was, but trying to make sense of it was impossible. It just seemed incomprehensible marks carved in a piece of wood. Chicken scratchings made no less sense. She couldn't remember a chicken scratching. She couldn't understand how people remembered the seemingly indecipherable marks that made up words, but they did. Once again, she hoisted the cloth bag holding all her belongings. It had been an awkward load to lug along, what with it bouncing against her thigh, but it wasn't unbearably heavy, and she often switched hands when her arm got tired. She didn't really have all that much to carry with her. Some clothes, her pair of cobbler-made shoes, which had belonged to her mother, and which Beata only wore for something special, so she wouldn't wear them out. A comb carved out of horn, soap, some keepsakes a few friends had given her, some water, a gift of some lace, and sewing supplies. Inger had given her a lot of food. She had a variety of sausages made from different meats, some as thick as her arm, some long and thin, some in coils. They were the heaviest things in her bag. Even though she had given several away to people she'd met who were hungry, and one to a farmer and his wife who gave her a ride in their wagon for 2 days, she still had enough sausages to last a year, it seemed. Inger had given her a letter, too. It was written on a fine piece of vellum and folded over twice. She couldn't read it, but he read it to her before she left so she'd know what it said. Every time she stopped for a rest along the way, she'd taken out the letter, carefully unfolded it in her lap and pretended to read it. She tried to remember just the way Inger told her the words, so she could try to tell which word was which. She couldn't. Hen scratching was all it was to her. Fitch made marks in the dust one time and told her it meant truth. Fitch. She shook her head. Inger hadn't wanted her to leave. He said he needed her. She said there were plenty of other people he could hire. He could hire a man with a back stronger than hers. He didn't need her. Inger said she was good at the work he needed. He said he cared about her almost as if she were his daughter. He told her about when her mother and father first came to work for him, and she was still a toddler. Inger's eyes were red when he asked her to stay. Beata almost cried again, but she held it in. She told him she loved him like a favorite uncle, and that was why she had to go. If she stayed, there would be trouble, and he would only be hurt because of it. He said he could handle it. She said if she stayed, she would be hurt or even killed, and she was afraid. He had no answer for that. Inger had always made her work hard, but he was fair. He always made sure she was fed. He never beat her. Sometimes he'd backhand one of the boys if they talked back to him, but never the girls. But then the girls didn't talk back to him in the first place. Once or twice he'd gotten angry at her, but he never hit her. If she did something foolish enough to get him angry, he'd make her gut and debone pullets till well into the night. She didn't have to do that very often, though. She always tried her best to do right and not cause trouble. There was one thing Beata thought was important. It was doing as she was told and not causing trouble. She knew she'd been born with a vile Haken nature, just like all Hakens, and she wanted to try to act better than her nature. Every once in a great while, Inger would wink at her and tell her she'd done a good job. Beata would have done anything for those winks. Before she left, he hugged her for a long time, and then sat her down while he wrote out the letter for her. When he read it to her, she thought he had tears in his eyes. It was all she could do to keep hers from erupting again. Beata's mother and father had taught her not to cry in front of others, or they would think her weak and foolish. Beata was careful to only cry at night, when no one would hear her. She could always hold it back until night, in the dark, alone. Inger was a good man, and she would greatly miss him, even if he did work her fingers to the bone. She wasn't afraid of work. Beata wiped her nose and then sidestepped to make way for a wagon rolling toward the gateway. It looked a big place. At the same time, it looked lonely, all by itself out in the windswept middle of nowhere, sitting up on its own low hill. The gate, through the bulwark, appeared the only way in, except straight up the steep earthwork ramparts. As soon as the wagon went by, Beata followed it through the tall gates and into the bailey. People were bustling about everywhere. It was like a town inside the gates. It surprised her to see so many buildings, with streets and alleyways between them. A guard, just inside, finished talking to the wagon driver and waved him on. He turned his attention to Beata. He gave her a quick glance up and down, not showing anything of what he might be thinking. "Good day." He used the same tone as he used with the wagon driver, polite but businesslike. There were more wagons coming up behind her, and he was busy. She returned the greeting in kind. The dark ander hair at his neck was damp from sweat. It was probably hot in his heavy uniform. He lifted a hand and pointed. "Over there, second building on the right." He gave her a wink. "Good luck." She nodded her thanks and hurried between horses before they closed up, and she'd have to go all the way around. She narrowly missed stepping in fresh manure with her bare feet. Crowds of people were going in every direction. Horses and wagons made their way up and down the streets. It smelled of sweat, horses, leather, dust, dung, and the new wheat growing all around. Beata had never been any place but Fairfield before. It was intimidating, but it was also exciting. She found the second building on the right easy enough. Inside, an Ander woman was sitting behind a desk, writing on a rumpled, well-used piece of paper. She had a whole stack of papers to one side of her desk, some well-worn and some fresh-looking. When the woman looked up, Beata curtsied.
"Afternoon, dear."
She gave Beata a look up and down, as the guard had done.
"Long walk?"
"From Fairfield, ma'am." The woman set down her dipping pen.
"Fairfield? Then it was a long walk. No wonder you're covered in dust."
Beata nodded.
"6 days, ma'am."
A frown crept onto the woman's face. She looked to be a woman who frowned a lot.
"Why do you come here, then, if you're from Fairfield?"
There were any number of closer stations. Beata knew that. She didn't want a closer station. She wanted to be far away from Fairfield, far away from trouble. Inger had told her to come here to the 23rd.
I worked for a man named Inger, ma'am. He's a butcher. When I told him what I wanted, he said he'd been here and knew there to be good people here. It was upon his counsel I came here, ma'am.
She smiled with one side of her mouth.
Don't recall a butcher named Inger, but he must have been here because he's right about our people here.
Beata set down her bag and pulled out the letter.
Like I said, he counseled I come here, ma'am.
He counseled her to get far away from Fairfield, and this place was. She feared stepping closer to the desk, so she leaned forward and stretched to hand her precious letter to the woman.
He sent this letter of introduction.
The woman unfolded the letter and leaned back to read it. Watching her eyes going along each line, Beata tried to remember Inger's words. She was sorry to find the exact words fading. It wouldn't be long before she recalled only the main thrust of Inger's words. The woman set down the letter.
Well, Master Inger seems to think a great deal of you, young lady. Why would you want to leave a job where you got along so well?
Beata hadn't been expecting to have anyone ask her why she wanted to do this. She thought briefly and quickly decided to be honest, but not too honest.
This has always been my dream, ma'am. I guess that a person has to try out their dreams sometimes. No use in living your life and never trying your dream. And why is it your dream? Because I want to do good, and because the minister made it so women would be respected here, so they'd be equal.
The minister is a great man.
Beata swallowed her pride. Pride did a person no good. It only held them back.
Yes, ma'am, he is. Everyone respects the minister. He passed the law allowing Haken women to serve along with the Ander men and women. That law also says all must show respect to those Haken women who serve our land. Haken women owe him a great debt. Minister Chanbur is a hero to all Haken women.
The woman regarded her without emotion.
And you had man trouble, am I right? Some man wouldn't keep his hands off you, and you finally had enough and finally got up the courage to leave.
Beata cleared her throat.
Yes, ma'am, that's true. But what I told you about this always being my dream is true, too.
The man just decided for me sooner, that's all. It's still my dream, if you'll have me. The woman smiled.
Very good. What's your name, then?
Beata, ma'am.
Very good, Beata. We try to follow Minister Chanbur's example here and do good.
That's why I came, ma'am, so I could do good.
I'm Lieutenant Yarrow. You call me Lieutenant.
Yes, ma'am, Lieutenant.
So, may I join?
Lieutenant Yarrow pointed with her pen.
Pick up that sack over there.
Beata hoisted the burlap sack. It felt like it was loosely filled with firewood. She curled a wrist under it and held it against a hip with one arm.
Yes, Lieutenant. What would you like done with it?
Put it up on your shoulder. Beata hoisted it up and curved her arm around and forward over the sack so it would bulge up the muscle and the wood wouldn't rest on her shoulder bone. She stood waiting.
All right, Lieutenant Yarrow said. You can put it down.
Beata set it back where it had been.
You pass, the lieutenant said. Congratulations. Your dream just came true. You're in the Andereth army.
Hakens can never be completely cleansed of their nature, but here you will be valued and be able to do good.
Beata felt a sudden swell of pride. She couldn't help it.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
The lieutenant waggled her pen, pointing it back over her shoulder.
Out back, down the alleyway to the end, just below the rampart, you will find a midden heap. Take your bag out there and throw it on with the rest of the offal.
Beata stood in mute shock. Her mother's shoes were in there. They were expensive. Her mother and father had saved for years to buy those shoes. There were keepsakes in her bag, given by her friends. Beata held back tears.
Am I to throw out the food Inger sent too, Lieutenant?
The food too.
Beata knew that if an Ander woman told her to do it, then it was right and she had to do it.
Yes, Lieutenant. May I be excused, then, to see to it?
The woman appraised her for a moment. Her tone softened a little.
It's for your own good, Beata. Those things are from your old life. It won't do you any good to be reminded of your old life. The sooner you forget it, food included, the better.
Yes, Lieutenant, I understand.
Beata forced herself to be bold.
The letter, ma'am. May I keep the letter Inger sent with me?
Lieutenant Yarrow looked down at the letter on her desk. She finally folded it twice and handed it back.
Since it's a letter of recommendation and not a memento of your old life, you may keep it. You earned it with your years of service to the man. Vieta touched the pin that held closed her collar at her throat, the one with the spiral end, the one Fitch had returned to her. Her father had given it to her when she was young, before he had died from a fever. She had lost it when the minister and that beast Stein pulled it out and tossed it away into the hall so they could open her dress and have a look at her. The pin, Lieutenant Yarrow, should I throw it away too? As she had watched her father making the simple pin, he had told her it represented how everything was all connected, even if you couldn't see it from where you stood, and how if you could follow everything round and round, someday it would all come to a point. He told her to always keep her dreams, and if she did good, the dreams would come round to her, even if it was in the afterlife. And it was the good spirits themselves answered the wishes. She knew it was a silly children's story, but she liked it. The lieutenant squinted as she peered at the pin. Yes, from now on, the people of Andorith will provide everything you require. Yes, lieutenant. I look forward to serving them well to repay them for the opportunity only they could provide. A smile softened the woman's face. You're smarter than most who come in here, Beata. Men and women both. You catch on quick, and you accept what's required of you. That's a good quality. The lieutenant stood up behind her desk. I think with training you could be a good leader, maybe a sergeant. It's tougher than plain soldier training, but if you can measure up, in a week or two you'll be in charge of your own squad. In charge of a squad? In only a week or two? The lieutenant shrugged. It's not difficult being in the army. I'm sure it's a lot less difficult than learning to butcher. Won't we have to learn to fight? Yes, but while important at a basic level, fighting is for the most part a trivial and outmoded function of the army. The army was once a refuge for extremists. The fanaticism of warriors suffocates the society they are charged with protecting. She smiled again. Brains are the major requirement, and women are more than equal there. With the Domini Dirch, brawn is unnecessary. The weapon itself is the brawn, and as such, invincible. Women have the natural compassion required to be officers. For instance, the way I explained why you must discard your old things. Men don't bother with explaining to their troops why something is necessary. Leadership is a nurturing of those under your command. Women bring wholesomeness to what used to be nothing but a savage fellowship of destruction. Women who defend Andorith are given the recognition to which they are entitled, the recognition they earn. We help the army contribute to our culture instead of simply menace it as before. Beata glanced down at the sword at Lieutenant Yarrow's hip. Will I get to carry a sword and everything? And everything, Beata. Swords are made to wound in order to discourage an opponent, and you will be taught how. You will be a valued member of the 23rd Regiment. We are all proud to serve under Bertrand Chanbor, the Minister of Culture. The 23rd Regiment. That was where Inger told her he thought she should go to join the 23rd Regiment. That was what the sign over the gate had said. The 23rd Regiment was the one that tended the Domini Dirch. Inger said soldiers who tend the Domini Dirch had the best job in the army and were the most respected. He called them the elite. Beata thought back to Inger. It already seemed another life. As she had been leaving his place, Inger gently took a hold of her arm and turned her back. He said he believed some man at the estate had hurt her and asked her to tell him if that was true. She nodded. He asked her to tell him who it was. Beata told him the truth. He had cleared his throat and told her he finally understood why she had to leave. Inger was probably the only Ander who would have believed her or cared. Inger had wished her a good life. Again, the captain ordered. Beata, being first in line, lifted the sword and ran forward. She stabbed with her weapon at the straw man swinging by a rope. This time she ran her sword right through his leg. Beautiful, Beata, Captain Talbert said. He always praised them when he approved of what they did. Being Haken, Beata found such praise an odd experience. She almost fell trying to pull the sword back out of the straw man's leg as she ran past. She at least managed it, if not with grace. Sometimes the others didn't. Fortunately for Beata, she had years of experience with blades. Although the blades had been smaller,
She knew something about wielding blades and stabbing them where you intended. Despite being Haken and supposedly not allowed to use knives because they were weapons, Beata had worked for a butcher, and so it was overlooked, since butchers were Ander and they kept a tight rein on their Haken workers. Butchers only let the Haken girls and women cut up meat, along with the Anders. The Haken boys and men working for them did the lifting and lugging mostly, the things not requiring them to handle blades. Three of the other girls, Corrine, Emmeline, and Annette, were Haken too, and had never held anything more than a dull bread knife before. The four Ander boys, Turner, Norris, Carl, and Bryce, were not from wealthy families and had never handled a sword before either, but as boys they had played with sticks as swords. Beata knew that Anders were better than Hakens in every way, but she was having a difficult time making sure she didn't wrongly show up Turner, Norris, Carl, and Bryce. They were best suited to grinning moronically. That was about it as far as she could tell. Most of the time they pranced around bragging about themselves to each other. The two Ander girl recruits, Estelle Ruffin and Marie Favelle, didn't have any experience with swords either. They did like swinging their new swords about, though, as did the rest of them. They were better at it, too, than the four Ander boys. For that matter, even the Haken girls, Corrine, Emmeline, and Annette, were better than the three boys at soldiering. The boys could swing harder, but the girls were better at hitting the target. Captain Tolbert pointed that out so the boys would understand they weren't any better than the girls. He said to the boys that it didn't matter how hard you could swing a sword if you couldn't hit anything. Carl had gashed his leg the first day, and it had to be sewn closed. He hobbled around, still grinning, a soldier with a scar in the works. Emmeline poked at the straw man's leg as she ran by. She missed the swinging leg, and her sword's tip caught in the rope around the straw waist. She fell flat on her Haken face. The four Ander boys erupted in laughter. The girls, Ander and Haken, both didn't. The boys called Emmeline a clumsy ox and a few other rude things under their breath. Captain Tolbert growled in anger as he snatched the collar of the nearest, Bryce.
I've told you before, you may have laughed at others in your old life, but not here. You don't laugh at your fellow soldiers, even if that soldier is a Haken. Here you are all equal.
He shoved Bryce away.
Such a violation of respect to fellow soldiers requires punishment. I want each of you to name for me what you think a fair punishment.
Captain Tolbert pointed at Annette and asked her to name a fair punishment. She thought a moment and then said she thought the boys should apologize. Corrine and Emmeline, the other two Haken girls, spoke up that they agreed. He asked Estelle. She pushed back her dark Ander hair and said the boys should be kicked out of the army. Marie Favelle agreed, but added they could be let back in the next year. The four boys, when asked their idea of fair punishment, said just to be told not to do it again. Captain Tolbert turned to Beata.
You hope to be a sergeant. What would you say was a good punishment if you were a sergeant?
Beata had her answer ready.
If we're all equal, then we should all be treated equal. Since the four of them think it so funny, the whole squad should have to dig a new latrine instead of having dinner.
She folded her arms.
If any of us gets hungry as we're digging, well, we have these four boys to thank.
Captain Tolbert smiled with satisfaction.
Beata has named a fair punishment. That will be it, then. If anyone objects, they can head home for their mother's skirts, because they don't have the courage it takes to be a soldier and stick up for their fellow soldiers.
Estelle and Marie, Anders both, cast dark glares at the Ander boys. The boys hung their heads and stared at the ground. The Haken girls weren't any happier about it, but the boys were more worried about the glares from the Ander girls.
Now, Captain Tolbert said, let's finish the drill so you can all get to digging when the dinner bell is rung.
No one groaned. They had learned better than to complain. Sweat ran down Beata's neck as they marched two abreast along the narrow road. It was a path, really, just two ruts from the supply wagons. Captain Tolbert led them. Beata was at the head of the five soldiers in the left rut, and Marie Favelle marched to her right at the head of the five soldiers behind her. Beata felt pride marching in front of her squad of soldiers. She had worked hard the 2 weeks of training and had been named sergeant, just as Lieutenant Yarrow said she might. Beata had the stripes of the rank sewn on each shoulder. Marie and Ander was named corporal, second in command of the squad. The other eight had earned the rank of soldier. Beata guessed the only real earning to it was that if you got kicked out before you finished the training, then you didn't get to be a soldier. None of them that started got kicked out, though. The uniform was uncomfortable in the afternoon heat, although she was getting used to it. They all wore green trousers. Over that, they wore long padded and quilted tan tunics, cinched at the waist with a light belt. Over the tunic, they wore chainmail. Because the mail was heavy, the women had to wear only vested chainmail without sleeves. The men had to wear mail with arms of mail, too, and it was longer. They also had to wear a hood of mail that covered their head and necks. When they were marching, they swathed it down around their necks. When they had to wear it, they wore a leather helmet over top. They all had leather helmets. Beata was thankful the women didn't have to wear all the rest of it, though. Being a sergeant, she had to sometimes pick up the men's mail to inspect it. She couldn't imagine marching all day with that much weight. What she had was enough. The fun of marching with a heavy sword had worn off. Now it was a chore. They each had a long cloak, but with it being as warm as it was, the cloaks were only buttoned to their right shoulders, letting them hang to the side. Over the mail, they wore their sword belts. Additionally, they each carried a pack, and, of course, their two spears each and a knife worn opposite their sword on the same belt. Beata thought they looked a smart squad. The pikemen she had seen back at the 23rd Regiment had been the best-looking soldiers. They were a sight. The men were handsome in the pikemen outfits. She had pleasant dreams about those men. The women somehow looked dull by comparison, even though they had the same outfits. Beata saw something dark ahead, standing up above the field of grass. As they got closer, she thought it looked to be ancient stone. Off behind it, closer to them, were three squat stone buildings. The roofs were shingled, maybe with slate. Beata felt a twinge of dread at seeing the huge, silent, awful thing. It was the Dominie Dirch. The Dominie Dirch were the one thing of the Hakens the Anders kept to use. Beata recalled the lessons she learned about how the Hakens murdered countless Anders with these weapons. They were terrible things. It looked as old as it was, its edges softened over time by the weather, the wind, and the hands that tended it. At least, now that the Anders governed them, they were only instruments of peace. Captain Tolbert halted them among the buildings. Beata could see soldiers up on the stone base of the enormous bell-shaped stone Dominie Dirch. There were soldiers in the buildings, too. The squad there had been at station for months and was being relieved by Beata's squad. Captain Tolbert turned to them. "These are the barracks, one for the women and one for the men. See, it stays that way, Sergeant Beata. The other buildings are used for kitchen and dining, meetings, repairs, and everything else." He pointed to the farther building. "That over there is storage." He ordered them to follow as he marched on. They marched behind him in their two neat rows as he went past the Dominie Dirch. It towered over them, a dark menace. The three women and one man up on the base around the bell-shaped part watched them pass. Out in front of the Dominie Dirch a ways, he stopped and told them to be at ease and to spread out. They formed a loose line, shoulder to shoulder. "This is the frontier, the border of Andorath," the captain pointed out at the seemingly endless grassland. "That out there is the wilds. Beyond this place are the lands of other peoples. We keep those others from coming and taking our land from us." Beata felt her chest swelling with pride. She was the one protecting the Andorath border. She was doing good. "Over the next 2 days, I and the squad here will teach you what you need to know about guarding the border and about the Dominie Dirch." He walked down the line and halted in front of Beata, looking her in the eye. He smiled with pride. "Then you will be under the capable charge of Sergeant Beata. You will follow her orders without fail, and if she is unavailable, the orders of Corporal Marie Favel." He gestured behind them. "I will take a report from the squad I led back to the 23rd Regiment, and I will treat very harshly any soldier who failed to at all times follow the orders of their sergeant." He glared at the entire line. "Keep that in mind. Keep in mind, too, that the sergeant has a responsibility to live up to her rank. If she fails in that, I expect you to report it when I come back for you when it's your turn to be relieved. Supply wagons will be coming once every 2 weeks. Keep your supplies orderly and mind how long they must last. Your primary duty
is to tend the Dominie Dirch. In that, you are the defense of our beloved land of Andereth. From up on the watch station of the Dominie Dirch, you will be able to see the next Dominie Dirch to each side. They extend along the entire border to guard the frontier. The squads on duty are not changed at the same time, so experienced soldiers are always to each side. Sergeant Beata, it will be your responsibility, once your squad is trained and we depart, to see to it your soldiers are on duty at your Dominie Dirch, and then to go meet with the squads to each side to coordinate with them all matters of defense. Beata saluted with a hand to her brow. Yes, Captain. He smiled. I'm proud of you all. You all are good Andereth soldiers, and I know you will do your duty. Behind her towered the terrible Haken weapon of murder. Now she was to be in charge of it in order to do good. Beata felt a lump in her throat. For the first time in her life, she knew she was doing good. She was living her dream, and it was good.